Welcome to Foresight Friday Roundup, Foresight Health's podcast series for healthcare revolutionaries. Outcomes matter, customers count, and value rules. Hello again, everyone. This is Dave Berta, news editor at Foresight Health. It is Friday, September 3rd. When August ends and September begins, do you start thinking what I start thinking? Right. It's time for the latest figures on the solvency of the Medicare Trust Fund and the latest figures on the number of uninsured Americans. What a season. So on today's episode of the Roundup, we're going to talk about the new Medicare Trust Fund report and the new uninsured report from the CDC. To tell us what the report said and what they mean moving forward are Dave Johnson, founder and CEO of Foresight Health, and Julie Murchison, partner at Transformation Capital. Hi, Dave. Hi, Julie. How are you guys doing this morning? Dave?
What a week. Fires, drought, hurricanes, flooding, rampaging COVID, and the new Texas law that effectively outlaws abortions after only 6 weeks. Reminds me of a verse from an old Kingston Trio song. There's rioting in Africa. There's strife in Iran. What Mother Nature doesn't do to us will be done by our fellow man. I'm just glad, Dave, it's a long weekend.
It sounds like we all could use some rest. Julie, how about you?
Well, we are all about back to school in our household. And I have to say, it's been a very chaotic summer with everything that Dave just talked about. I'm excited to get back to some sort of even beat.
Yeah, no, here. Now, before we talk about Medicare solvency and the uninsured, let's talk about your Labor Day weekend plans. As Dave mentioned, it's a long weekend coming up. There's not much of a connection there with our topic, but we'll try. Dave, how are you celebrating Labor Day? Any parades going through your neighborhood in Chicago?
Our local Woogums Parade is a go for this Labor Day. WOGAM stands for the Wellington Oakdale Old Glory Marching Society. The parade began in 1963. Local residents have marched every Memorial and Labor Day since then, except for the last three. Its slogan is, everybody marches and nobody watches. The parade ends at St. Joe's Hospital, just down the street, with popsicles and the Jesse White tumblers. It's outdoors and it's fun. But we'll see if Terry and I march this year. If we do, we'll probably march with masks.
I thought your answer to that question was going to be no.
Yeah.
I'm glad I asked. All right. Julie, how about you? What are your plans for this three-day weekend?
Well, we're back on the East Coast in Cape Cod and trying to get our kitschy Americana in. Very excited for it.
Are you going to go to I think it's on Nantucket Island, the Old Whalers Museum. You ever been there?
Oh, I haven't. Maybe I should go while I'm here.
Yeah, it's excellent. All right.
I don't know that the island's letting foreigners on, though, during COVID times.
Oh, right. All right. Thank you. For me, it's our annual family picnic on my mother's side, which is always held the Sunday before Labor Day. We skipped it last year because of COVID, so it will be nice to see everyone this year. And I use that term see loosely because most of us will be wearing masks. At least I hope so. We'll see. Okay, let's talk about the solvency of the Medicare Trust Fund. The Board of Trustees of the Federal Hospital Insurance and Federal Supplementary Medical Insurance Trust Funds, that's a mouthful, released its annual report this week. The report said that the Hospital Insurance Trust Fund, which covers Medicare Part A inpatient hospital care, will be solvent through 2025 and able to pay 100% of its bills, but that ends the following year in 2026, and that percentage drops to 91. That's the same 2026 insolvency projection that the trustees made last year. Dave, a lot has happened in the past year, but the hospital trust fund held firm. What does that tell you, and what does that tell you moving forward?
First, I'm not surprised by the result. 2020 is the starting point for the trustees' funding analysis. Healthcare spending actually decreased in 2020, largely due to the dramatic decline in elective procedures. On that basis alone, it's logical that the fund's impending solvency date didn't move up. But as you said, Dave, a lot happened last year, so there's more to their 2020 conclusion than just reduced healthcare spending. Pardon me if this gets a little wonky. First, contributions to the Medicare Trust Fund were way down because of the effect COVID had on the overall economy. Less revenue collected by the fund offset its lower spending on healthcare treatments. Medicare then increased its accelerated payments to hospitals. It also pays for all COVID tests, vaccines, and COVID care. Those programs increase Medicare spending, but cost less than Medicare would have spent on elective procedures absent COVID. The report punted on the potential budget-busting implications of Aduhelm, the controversial Alzheimer's drug that the FDA approved earlier this year. Despite its high cost, Aduhelm's efficacy is minimal and its uptake has been slow. The commissioners are taking a wait-and-see approach. That makes sense to me. The report also comments on the high rate of uncertainty affecting its solvency projections. That observation reminds me of Yogi Berra's quote that predictions are difficult, especially about the future. My favorite passage about healthcare's uncertainty from the report comes from the introduction. Here it is, quote, spurred by economic incentives, the institutions through which care is delivered will evolve, possibly becoming more efficient. While most healthcare technological advances to date have tended to increase expenditures, the healthcare landscape is shifting. No one knows whether future developments will, on balance, increase or decrease costs. You can just feel the commissioners' collective skepticism and concern. Throw it all together and the statistical law of compensating error takes hold. So this year's projection is the same as last year's projection. But in the words of Chicago Cubs fans everywhere, wait until next year.
That's great. Thanks, Dave. Julie, what do you think is going on? Is this just a useless actuarial exercise, or are there some lessons to be learned from the report?
Well, you know, this has been David Shulkin's soapbox ever since he left the VA. And when you talk to him about this, he has a very dark perspective. This Hospital Insurance Trust Fund has been center stage for years because it is the payer of the major hospital bills. And what I have trouble with these reports is that the headlines don't often really reflect the underlying details and what it really means to what the industry is doing. So we're concerned about this one because it pays the big bills and it keeps our hospitals afloat. As Dave said, you know, what's not surprising is the impact on the fund has largely been similar to what health plans have experienced, maybe with the exception of the revenue impact. But there's a couple other notes that I think are worth looking at. A few other funds that we should be worried about and that also give us hope. The first is, you know, the Old Age and Survivors Insurance Trust Fund and the Disability Trust Fund effectively make up our Social Security. And both of those are literally right behind this Hospital Insurance Trust Fund in their fund depletion estimates. In other words, they're at risk also. So we've heard about Social Security in the news over the past few years as well. These two funds are significant and at risk. But when you look at a few of the other funds, the Part B and Part D funds, which we actually talk a lot about in the industry as revenue sources, right? But in this context, Part B pays for physician and outpatient services that hospitals provide, and Part D pays for prescription drugs. These are both better funded more indefinitely. And what this says to me is, gosh, if we could just get our act together and really be moving care from inpatient settings, from sick care, from acute care into preventative, into managing, you know, personalized population-oriented health in other settings in the home and outpatient, we may have the ability to do so at lower cost and use Part B and Part D to fund it. We wouldn't be so concerned about Part A. So if you listen to the trustees at this report, they're concerned. They want things to move more quickly so that we have time to really transition these funds. And while this is what the industry is heading towards, we're not all focused on this as one of our common problems as a country and a driver for why we're doing what we're doing. Something else I found interesting, which has nothing to do with that soapbox, is a few of the assumptions that the trustees made. They looked at short-term immigration and childbearing as decreasing over the next couple of years because of COVID. And they see these returning to normal levels in the next few years, but I found that pretty interesting. And of course, they're assuming greater mortality rates due to COVID as well. So the little nuances that tweak this model that make a difference are fascinating.
Yeah, there's a lot going on behind the headlines. Thanks, Julie. Dave, anything to add to Julie's comments?
Oh, I want to pick up on that observation Julie made about the trustees and their need to come together broadly with Congress to manage the transition of American healthcare. I'm not sure why this surprised me, but it did. The board of the Medicare Trust Fund consists of four government officials, the secretaries of Treasury, HHS, Labor, as well as the Commissioner of Social Security. It's also supposed to have two public members that are confirmed by the Senate. There have been no public trustees since 2015. Those positions have remained vacant during the end of the Obama administration, the entire Trump administration, and now the beginning of the Biden administration. Senate confirmation of nominated trustees has become too high a hurdle to overcome, even though, as Julie mentioned, these issues are of paramount importance to the country as a whole. This is yet another example of the impact that political divisiveness is having on the effective development and administration of public policy, particularly healthcare public policy. Political gridlock favors the status quo and feeds the massive healthcare industrial complex. As Medicare's future stakes get higher, the wheels of the legislative process grind more slowly, and the political maneuvering increases. There are far too many pigs feeding at the Medicare trough and not enough resistance to stop them from their continued frenzy. You know, Dave, I really am glad that we have a long weekend coming up.
I think a lot of people feel that way. Interesting take. That's great, Dave. Thank you. Now let's talk about the uninsured. The CDC's National Center for Health Statistics said the number of uninsured in the U.S. was relatively unchanged last year, dropping to 31.6 million people from 33.2 million people in 2019. That's a dip to 9.7% of the population from 10.3% of the population. We should also note that the CDC's figures are different from the ones that the Census Bureau releases each year. The Census Bureau's numbers are due out later this month. Julie, again, a lot happened in 2020, but the needle on the uninsured barely moved. If anything, it moved in the right direction. What do you think happened and why?
Well, I get so excited when we see these headlines because it feels like, oh, we're moving in the right direction. But this 1.6 million is pretty much, you know, a rounding error on the overall population. There's still a significant number of uninsured in the country. And we have been through a lot. We know we lost a lot of jobs, which forced a lot of extended coverage and COBRA, as well as drove a number of people, maybe 1.6 million, to the health insurance exchanges and government-sponsored health plans, mostly Medicaid. And this is particularly true of those in the 18 to 64-year-old age range. We saw those with public health insurance grew by 2.1 million, whereas those with private health insurance only grew by 1.9 million. So we drove a lot of people onto the public rolls, which I think we knew we were doing and have been doing. Notable for me, I guess, interesting that more men are uninsured than women. I hadn't seen that stat before, probably the last one to know. And of course, we're reminded that the data is quite imperfect. Officials said that they had to move to phone-based surveying in March 2020 because of COVID, so that the data may be impacted by, you know, much lower numbers of respondents, which just makes this whole conversation questionable. And Dave makes me want to wait for the numbers coming out later this month.
Got it. Thanks, Julie. Dave, what are your takeaways from the CDC's numbers, and what do they say about 2021 and beyond?
That's an interesting statistic, Julie, about women having more insurance than men. I wonder if that corresponds back to Medicaid coverage for pregnancy and childcare. It could be interesting to dig into that.
I suspect it does, because more women are on public insurance than men, which definitely is related to that.
Yeah. So I thought your point about the composition of the insured in America was spot on. That shift was far more significant than the slight increase in the number of insured people. There's more government insurance and less privately funded commercial health insurance than there was a year ago. And since governmental insurance pays less, providers are becoming even more dependent on the premium payments they receive for treatments from commercial insurers, even payments for routine treatments. Differential pricing for identical services is a unique and deviant feature of the U.S. healthcare system. I'm still haunted, Julie, by your observation or statistic from our podcast on hospitals' noncompliance with the new price transparency rule, that the price of a diagnostic colonoscopy in Virginia ranges between $208 and $10,563, a 50-fold pricing differential, almost too large to believe. In my opinion, healthcare's artificial economics are not sustainable, particularly as more Americans move to lower-paying government-funded health insurance programs. But don't expect the status quo business models to propel the transformation that needs to occur, the very kind of transformation, Julie, you were describing in shifting toward lower-cost settings and more investment in behavioral health and chronic disease management and so forth. But while we're at it, 10% of Americans without health insurance is 10% too many. The industry needs to develop a pluralistic model that provides universal healthcare coverage. Absent coverage and cost improvement, the single-payer crowd gains steam in their push for Medicare for All, which I believe, and as we've discussed many times, would be a policy disaster. Julie, we're counting on you to fund revolutionary companies that will reverse the healthcare industry's perverse trajectory by giving better healthcare to more people without breaking the bank.
I believe that's a call to action. Thanks, Dave. Julie, anything to add to Dave's comments?
Well, we're doing our best. It's not easy. I would just add that, Dave, your mention of transparency is, I think, a critical one here, because as we're putting more Americans in public insurance or private insurance through the health exchanges, we have more control there to see more pricing and to drive more controls like we do through Medicare Advantage. So we're on the right track with all that, but we really need to make some progress to be able to actually start to take action on what that data is telling us.
Got it. Thanks, Julie. It seems like our public health insurance program stood tall during the pandemic, so that's good. We just need to keep the government's hands off our Medicare and Medicaid. Right? You can just hear it now, right? All right, let's talk briefly about other big news this past week. Julie, what other healthcare news made your front page?
Yeah, I'm not going to lie. For me, the Texas abortion law situation hits close to home as a woman raising a daughter and a staunch believer in choice. And I know that we, the broad we, are taking advantage of this time of divisiveness and, you know, being in our own camps to really go for the jugular on these things. But it concerns me, and I think we all need to pay attention and start making some action happen.
Yeah, I totally agree. Thanks, Julie. Dave, what else happened this week that's worth mentioning, and why?
That Texas ruling is really abhorrent and reminds me of the William Butler Yeats line from The Second Coming, that the best lack all conviction and the worst are filled with passion and intensity. It's really crazy. So along those lines, the federal judge's approval of the Sackler family's settlement for their role in the opioid crisis is the one that got my attention this week, really sticks in my craw. More than 500,000 Americans have died from opioid overdoses. It's wreaked havoc on countless American communities. Not only is the Sackler family not being prosecuted for the plague they helped unleash on the American public, but they aren't even admitting wrongdoing. No penitence, no shame. Their $4.5 billion settlement is just more blood money.
Yeah, thanks, Dave. Yeah, I think the one that caught my attention was Baxter buying Hill Rom. That announcement came out late yesterday. So it's like, you want a hospital bed with that IV fluid? So we'll see what happens there. That is all the time we have for today. If you'd like to learn more about the topics we discussed, please visit our website at foresighthealth.com. You also can find a recording of this podcast and all our podcasts on the Healthcare Now Radio Network, iTunes, Spotify, and other streaming services. Subscribe now and don't miss another segment of the best 20 minutes in healthcare. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Berta for Foresight Health.